telling the story. Meantime, Chu came in from the balcony to listen as well. "Last night at 8:50, the front desk gets a call from a man identifying himself as George Irving. He reserves a room for the night and says he's on the way. He specifically asks what rooms with balconies they've got on the top floor. They give him a choice, and he takes 79. He gives an American Express number to hold the room, and it checks out to the card in his wallet, which is in the bedroom in the safe." Glanville pointed down a hallway to Bosch's left. Harry saw an open doorway at the end and a bed. "Okay, so he shows up at 9:40, Glanville continued. "He valets his car in the garage, uses the Amex to register, and then goes up to his room. Nobody sees him alive again."
"Until they find him on a sidewalk down below," Solomon said.
"When?"
Bosch asked.
"At 5:50, one of the kitchen guys reports for work. He's heading up the sidewalk to get to the rear entrance, where the time card rack is located. He finds the body. Patrol comes out first, then we get called when they make a tentative ID. Bosch nodded and looked around the room. There was a writing table next to the balcony door.
"No note?"
"Not that we found in here."
Having received the basic story, Bosch stepped through the French doors onto the balcony. There was a small table and two chairs. A white terry cloth robe had been left lying across one of the chairs. Bosch looked down over the edge. The first thing he noticed was that the balustrade came up only to the top of his thighs. It seemed low to him, and while he had no idea how tall Irving had been, he immediately had to consider the possibility of an accidental fall. He wondered whether that was what he was here for. Nobody wants a suicide on the family ledger. An accidental tumble over a low balustrade was far more acceptable. He looked directly down and saw the canopy the forensic team had put up. He also saw the body on a gurney and covered in a blue blanket being loaded into the coroner's van.
"I know what you're thinking,"
Solomon said from behind him.
"Yeah? What am I thinking?" "That he didn't jump. That it was an accident."
Bosch didn't respond.
"But there are things to consider."
"What are they?"
"The guy's naked. The bed isn't slept in. And he didn't check in with any luggage. He just checked into a hotel room in his own city without a suitcase. He asked for the top floor. He then goes up to his room, takes off his clothes, puts on the bathrobe they give you in a place like this, and goes out on the balcony to contemplate the stars or something. He then takes off the bathrobe and falls face-fucking-first off the balcony by accident?"
"And no scream," Glanville added. "Nobody reported a scream. That's why they didn't find him till this morning. You don't accidentally fall off a freaking balcony and not scream your lungs out."
"So maybe he wasn't conscious," Bosch suggested.
"Maybe he wasn't alone up here. Maybe it wasn't an accident."
"Oh, man, is that what this is about?"
Solomon said. "The councilman wants a murder investigation, and you're sent out to make sure he gets it?"
Bosch gave Solomon a look that let him know he was making a mistake, suggesting Harry was carrying out Irving's bidding.
"Look, nothing personal," Solomon said quickly. "I'm just saying we don't see that angle at all here. Suicide note or not, this scene adds up to only one thing, a high dive."
Bosch didn't respond. He noticed the fire escape ladder at the other end of the balcony. It led up to the roof and down to the balcony below on the sixth floor.
"Anybody go up on the roof?"
"Not yet," Solomon said. "We were awaiting further instructions."
"What about the rest of the hotel? Did you knock on any doors?"
"Same thing. Further instructions."
Solomon was being an ass, but Bosch ignored it.
"How did you confirm ID on the body? The facial damage was extensive."
"Yeah, this one's going to be a closed casket," Granville said. "That's for sure. We got the name off the hotel registration and the plate on the car in valet," Solomon said.
This was before we got the room safe open and found the wallet. We figured we better be sure and we better be quick. I had patrol send over the division's MPR and got it off the guy's thumb. Each of the department's divisions had a mobile print reader that took a digital thumbprint and instantly compared it to the Department of Motor Vehicles database. It was primarily used in the station house jails to confirm IDs, as there had been several incidents in which felons sought on warrants had given false IDs upon arrest and were able to bail out before the jailers knew they'd had a wanted individual in custody. But the department was always looking for other applications of the equipment, and this had been a smart use of the new technology by Crate and Barrel.
"Good going," Bosch said.
He turned and looked at the bathrobe.
"Anybody check that?"
Solomon and Glanville looked at each other, and Bosch saw the exchange. Neither had checked, thinking the other had. Solomon went to the robe, and Bosch stepped back into the suite. As he did so, he spotted a small object next to the leg of the coffee table in front of the couch. He squatted down to see what it was without touching it. It was a small black button that had blended in with the dark pattern of the carpet. Bosch pulled a latex glove onto his left hand and took a small plastic evidence bag from his jacket. He then sealed the button in it and stood up. He could tell one of the detectives had come in from the balcony and was behind him.
"Where are his clothes?"
"Folded and hung nice and neat in the closet," Glanville said. "What was that?"
"A button, probably nothing.
Anything in the bathrobe?"
"The room key, that's it." Bosch headed down the hallway to the bedroom. Solomon had been right about the bed. The spread was neat and pulled tight at the corners. No one had even sat on the bed since it had been made. There was a closet with a mirrored door. As Bosch approached it, he could see Glanville in the room's doorway behind him, watching. He used the gloved hand to open the door. Irving's clothes were on hangers, shirt, pants, and jacket, and his underwear, socks, and shoes were on a side shelf next to a room safe with a partially open door. Inside the safe, he could see a wallet and a wedding ring, along with a cell phone and a watch. The safe had a 4-digit combination lock. Solomon had said it had been found closed and locked. Bosch knew that the hotel management most likely had an electronic reader that was used to unlock the room safes. People forget combinations or check out, forgetting they've locked the safe. The device quickly goes through the 10,000 possible combinations until it hits the winner.
What was the combination?
To the safe? I don't know. Maybe Jerry got it from her.
Her?
The assistant manager who opened it for us. Her name's Tamara.
Bosch removed the phone from the safe with his gloved hand. It was an iPhone, and he had the same model himself. But when he tried to access it, he found it was password protected.
What do you want to bet that the password he keyed into the safe is the same password as on the phone?
Glanville didn't answer. Bosch put the phone back into the safe.
We need to get somebody up here to bag this stuff.
We?
Bosch smiled, though Glanville couldn't see it. He slid the hangers apart and checked the pockets on the clothing. They were empty. He then started looking at the buttons on the shirt. It was a dark blue dress shirt with black buttons. He held the plastic bag with the found button up to compare. They looked like a match. He checked the rest of the shirt and found that the right cuff was missing a button. He felt Glanville come up and look over his shoulder.
"Looks like a match," Bosch said.
"Yeah, what's it mean?"
Glanville said. Bosch turned around and looked at him.
"I don't know."
Bosch moved back out to the suite's living room, and Glanville followed. Chu was on his phone, and Bosch gave him the cut-it-off sign. Chu put his hand over the phone and said, "I'm getting good stuff here."
"Yeah, we'll get it later," Bosch said. "We have things to do."
Chu got off the phone, and the four detectives stood in a circle in the middle of the room.
"Okay, this is how I want to do this," Bosch began.
"We're going to knock on every door in this building. We ask what people heard,
what they saw. We cover...
Jesus Christ, what a waste of time,
Solomon said, turning from the circle and looking out one of the windows.
We can leave no stone unturned, Bosch said. That way, if and when we call it suicide, nobody can second-guess us. Not the councilman, not the chief, not even the press. So the three of you split up the floors and start knocking on doors.
People in here are all night crawlers, Glanville said. They're still going to be sleeping.
That's good. That means we'll get to them before they get out of the building.
Okay, so we get to wake everybody up, Solomon said. What are you going to be doing?
I'm going down to see the manager. I want a copy of the registration and the combination used to lock the room safe. I'll see about cameras, and after that I'll check Irving's car in the garage. You never know. Maybe he left a note in the car. You two never checked it.
We would have gotten around to it,
Glanville said defensively.
Well, I'll get to it now, Bosch said.
The safe combo, Harry Chu asked? What for?
Because it might tell us whether it was Irving who punched it in.
Chu had a confused look on his face. Bosch decided he would explain it all later.
Chu, I also want you to climb that ladder out there and check the roof. Do that first, before you start knocking on doors.
Got it.
Thank you.
It was refreshing not to get a complaint. Bosch turned back to Crate and Barrel.
Now here's the part you two aren't going to like.
Oh, really? Solomon said. Imagine that.
Bosch walked over to the balcony doors, signaling them over. They stepped back out, and Bosch pointed a finger and swept it across the vista of homes that terraced the hillside. Though on the seventh floor, he was on an even level with numerous homes, with windows facing the chateau.
I want all of them canvassed, he said.
Use patrol if they can spare the bodies, but I want all those doors knocked on. Somebody might have seen something.
Don't you think we would have heard from them? Glanville said. You see a guy jump off a balcony, and I think you're going to call it in.
Bosch glanced from the view to Glanville, and then back to the view.
Maybe they saw something before the drop. Maybe they saw him out here alone. Maybe he wasn't alone. And maybe they saw him get thrown, and they're too scared to get involved.
Too many maybes to let it go, Crate. It has to be done.
He's Crate. I'm Barrel.
Sorry, couldn't tell the difference.
The disdain in Bosch's voice was unmistakable.
Chapter 6.
After finally clearing the scene, they took Laurel Canyon Boulevard over the hill to the San Fernando Valley. Along the way, Bosch and Chu traded reports on their efforts of the previous 2 hours, starting with the fact that the knocking on doors in the hotel had produced not a single guest who had heard or seen anything in regard to Irving's death. Bosch found this surprising. He was sure that the sound of the impact of the body landing would have been loud, and yet no one in the hotel had reported hearing even that.
A waste of time, Chu said.
Which, of course, Bosch knew was not the case. There was value in knowing that Irving had not shouted as he came down. This fact lent itself to the two scenarios Vanatta had mentioned. Irving had intentionally jumped, or was unconscious when he was dropped.
It's never a waste of time, he said. Did any of you knock on the doors of the pool bungalows?
Not me. They're all the way over on the other side of the building. I didn't figure it was...
What about Crate and Barrel?
I don't think so.
Bosch pulled his phone. He called Solomon.
What's your location? He asked.
We're on Marmont Lane, knocking on doors like we were told.
Did you get anything out of the hotel?
Nope. Nobody heard nothing.
Did you hit any of the bungalows?
There was a hesitation before Solomon answered.
Nope, we weren't told to hit the bungalows, remember?
Bosch was annoyed. I need you to go back and talk to a guest named Thomas Rapport in Bungalow 2.
Who's he?
He's supposedly some kind of famous writer. He checked in right after Irving and might have talked to him.
Let's see, that's about 6 hours or so before our guy jumped. And you want us to talk to a guy who was next in line to check in?
That's right. I do it myself, but I need to get to the Vic's wife.
Bungalow 2. Got it.
Today, you can email me the report. Bosch closed the phone, annoyed with Solomon's tone during the entire call. Chu immediately hit him with a question. How'd you know about this guy Rapport? Bosch reached into the side pocket of his suit coat and pulled free a clear plastic sleeve containing a DVD. There are not a lot of cameras in that hotel, but there is one over the front desk. It's got Irving checking in and the rest of the night right up until the body's discovered. Rapport came in right after Irving. He might have even ridden up in the elevator from the garage with him.
Did you look at the disc?
Just the part with him checking in. I'll watch the rest later.
Anything else from the manager?
The hotel call logs and the combination that was entered on the room safe. Bosch told him the combination on the room safe was 1492, and that it was not a default number. Whoever had locked Irving's possessions in the safe had keyed the number in either randomly or intentionally.
Christopher Columbus, Chu said.
What do you mean?
Harry, I'm the foreigner. Don't you know your history lessons? In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Remember?
Yeah, sure, Columbus. But what's it have to do with this?
It seemed like a stretch to Bosch that the discovery of North America was the inspiration for the combination.
And that's not even the oldest date connected to this thing, Chu added excitedly.
What are you talking about?
The hotel, Harry. The Chateau Marmont is a duplicate of a French chateau built in the 13th century in the Loire Valley.
Okay, so?
I looked it up on Google. That's what I was doing on my phone. Turns out that back then, the average height of Western Europeans was 5'3". So if they copied that place, that would explain why the balcony walls are so short.
The balustrades.
But what's that got to do? Accidental death, Harry. The guy comes out on the balcony to get some fresh air or something and goes right over the balcony. Do you know that Jim Morrison, that guy from the Doors, fell off a balcony there like in 1970?
That's great. What about a little more recently, Chu? Are you saying they have a...
No, there's no history there. I'm just saying. You know.
No, I don't know. What are you saying?
I'm saying that if we have to make this an accident so the chief and the powers that be are happy, then there's our way to it.
They had just crested the mountain and crossed Mulholland. They were now dropping down into Studio City, where George Irving had lived with his family. At the next street, Bosch jerked the wheel and pulled into Dona Pegita and stopped. He slammed the car into park and turned in his seat to confront his partner.
What gave you the idea that we're looking to appease the powers that be?
Chu immediately became flustered.
Well, I'm just saying if we want... Look, Harry, I'm not saying what happened. It's just a possibility.
Possibility, my ass.
He either checked in because he wanted to check out, or somebody drew him there, knocked him out, and then dropped him. There was no accident, and I'm not looking for anything but what really happened. If this guy offed himself, then he offed himself, and the councilman has to live with it.
Okay, Harry.
I don't want to hear about the Loire Valley or the Doors or anything else that is a distraction. There's a good chance it wasn't this guy's idea to end up on the sidewalk at the Chateau Marmont. Right now, it could go either way. And all politics aside, I'm going to find out.
I hear you, Harry. I didn't mean anything, okay? I was just trying to help. Casting a big net.
Remember, you told me that's how it's done.
Sure.
Bosch turned forward again and dropped the car into drive. He made a U-turn and headed back to Laurel Canyon Boulevard. Chu desperately tried to change the subject. Was there anything on the call logs worth looking at? No calls coming in. Irving called down to the garage about midnight, and that was it.
What was that about?
We have to talk to the Midnight Man. He got out of there before we could hold him. They keep a log in the office down there that says Irving called to ask him to see if he left his phone in his car. He obviously didn't, because we found it in the safe. They were silent for a moment as they considered the inexplicable call to the garage. Finally, Chu spoke.
Did you check out the car?
I did. There was nothing there.
Damn. I guess that would have made it easier if there had been a note or something.
Yeah, but there wasn't.
Too bad.
Yeah, too bad. They rode the rest of the way to George Irving's home in silence. When they got to the address that was on their victim's driver's license, Bosch saw a familiar Lincoln Town Car parked at the curb. The same two men were in the front. It meant Councilman Irving was on the premises. Bosch got ready for another face-to-face with the enemy. Chapter 7. Councilman Irving answered the door of his son's home. He opened it just as wide as his own body, and it was clear before he said anything that he did not want to allow Bosch and Chu admittance.
Councilman, Bosch said, we'd like to ask your son's wife a few questions.
Deborah's taken this very hard, Detective. It would be better if you could come back at another time.
Bosch looked around on the doorstep, even glanced behind him and down at Chu on the lower step before turning back to Irving and answering.
We're conducting an investigation, Councilman. Her interview is important and we can't put it off.
They stared at each other, neither yielding.
You asked for me and you told me to proceed with urgency, Bosch finally said. This is what I'm doing. Are you going to let us come in or not?
Irving relented and stepped back, opening the door wider. Bosch and Chu entered a vestibule with a table for dropping off keys and packages.
What did you learn from the crime scene? Irving said quickly.
Bosch hesitated, not sure whether to discuss the case with him this soon.
So far, not a lot. A case like this, a lot will ride on the autopsy.
When will that be?
It hasn't been scheduled.
Bosch checked his watch. Your son's body only got to the morgue an hour ago.
Well, I hope you insisted that they schedule it quickly.
Bosch tried to smile, but it didn't work out that way.
Can you take us to your daughter-in-law now?
So that means you did not insist on any urgency.
Bosch looked over Irving's shoulder and saw the room opened into a larger room with a winding staircase. There was no sign of anyone else in the house.
Councilman, don't tell me how to run the investigation. If you want to take me off it, then fine. Call the chief and have me pulled. But as long as I'm on the case, and I'm going to run the investigation the way I see best.
Irving backed off.
Of course, he said. I'll go get Deborah. Why don't you and your partner wait in the living room?
He led them into the house and directed them to the living room. He then disappeared. Bosch looked at Chu and shook his head at the same moment Chu was about to ask a question that Harry knew was going to be about Irving's meddling in the investigation. Chu held his tongue, and just then Irving returned, leading a stunningly beautiful blonde woman into the room. Bosch guessed she was in her mid-40s. She was tall and thin, but not too tall and thin. She looked grief-stricken, but that didn't take much away from the beauty of a woman who was aging as gracefully as a fine wine. Irving led her by the arm to a seat across a coffee table from a couch. Bosch moved into the seating arrangement, but did not sit down. He waited to see what move Irving made, and when it became clear the councilman planned on staying for the interview, Harry objected.
We're here to talk to Mrs. Irving, and we need to do that alone, he said.
My daughter-in-law wants me to be with her at this time, Irving responded. I'm not going anywhere.
That's fine. If you can be here somewhere in the house in case she needs you, that would be most helpful. But I need you to allow us to talk with Mrs. Irving alone.
Dad, it's okay, Deborah Irving said, diffusing the situation. I'll be fine. Why don't you make yourself something to eat in the kitchen?
Irving looked at Bosch for a long moment, probably second-guessing his demand that Harry be put on the case. Just call if you need me, he said. Irving then left the room, and Bosch and Chu sat down, Harry making their introductions. Mrs. Irving, I want...
You can call me Deborah.
Deborah, then.
We want you to know that you have our condolences for the loss of your husband. We also appreciate your willingness to talk to us at this difficult time.
Thank you, Detective. I am more than willing to talk. It's just that I don't think I have any answers for you, and the shock of this is more than...
She looked around herself, and Bosch knew what she was looking for. The tears were coming again. Harry signaled to Chu. Find her some tissue. Check the bathroom. Chu got up. Bosch intently watched the woman across from him, looking for signs of genuine emotion and loss.
I don't know why he would have done this, she said.
Why don't we start with the easy questions, the ones where there are answers? Why don't you tell me when you last saw your husband?
Last night. He left the house after dinner and didn't come back.
Did he say where he was going?
No, he said he needed air, that he was going to put the top down and take a drive up on Mulholland. He told me not to wait up for him. I didn't.
Bosch waited, but nothing else came. Was that unusual, him going out for a drive like that?
He had been doing it a lot lately. I didn't think he was really out driving, though.
You mean he was doing something else?
Connect the dots, Lieutenant.
I'm a detective, not a lieutenant. Why don't you connect the dots for me, Deborah? Do you know what your husband was doing?
No, I don't. I'm just telling you that I didn't think he was just riding around on Mulholland. I thought he was probably meeting someone.
Did you ask him about it?
No, I was going to, but I was waiting.
For what?
I don't know exactly. I was just waiting.
Chu came back with a box of tissues and handed them to her. But the moment had passed, and her eyes looked cold and hard now. Even so, she was beautiful, and Bosch found it hard to believe a husband would take to late-night drives when the woman waiting at home was Deborah Irving. Let's go back a second. You said he left after you two had dinner. Was that at home or had you been out?
We were home. Neither of us was very hungry. We just had sandwiches.
Do you remember what time dinner was?
It would have been about 7:30. He left at 8:30.
Bosch took out his notebook and wrote a few things down about what had been said so far. He remembered that Solomon and Glanville had reported that someone, presumably George Irving, had made the reservation at the chateau at 8:50, 20 minutes after Deborah said her husband had left their home. 1492.
Excuse me?
Do those numbers mean anything to you? 1492, 1492?
I don't understand what you mean.
She seemed genuinely confused. Bosch had meant to keep her off balance by asking questions in a non-sequential manner. Your husband's property, his wallet and phone and wedding ring, were in the hotel safe. That was the combination that was entered to lock it. Is there any significance to those numbers to your husband or you?
I can't think of any.
Okay. Did your husband have a familiarity with the Chateau Marmont? Had he stayed there before?
We had been there before together. But, like I said, I didn't really know where he went when he went on his drives. He could have been going there. I don't know.
Bosch nodded. How would you describe your husband's state of mind when you last saw him? She thought for a long moment before shrugging and saying that her husband seemed normal, not burdened or upset as far as she could tell.
How would you describe the state of your marriage?
She dropped her eyes to the floor for a moment before bringing them up to his.
We would have reached our 20th anniversary in January. 20 years is a long time. A lot of highs and lows, but many more highs than lows.
Bosch noted that she did not answer the question he had asked.
What about right now? Were you in a high or a low?
She paused a long moment before answering.
Our son, our only child, left in August for college. It has been a difficult adjustment.
Empty nest syndrome, Chu said. Both Bosch and Deborah Irving looked at him, but he added nothing else and looked a little foolish for interrupting.
What day in January was your anniversary? Bosch asked.
The 4th.
So you were married on January 4th, 1992?
Oh, my God.
She brought her hands to her mouth in embarrassment over not recognizing the hotel room safe combination. Tears rolled out of her eyes, and she pulled tissues from the box.
How stupid of me. You must think I'm a complete...
It's okay, Bosch offered.
I said it like a year, not a full date. Do you know if he used that number as a combination or password before?
She shook her head.
I don't know.
ATM password?
No, we used our son's birthday, 5293.
What about on his cell phone?
That's Chad's birthday, too. I've used George's phone.
Bosch wrote the new date down in his notebook. The cell phone had been logged into evidence by the SID team and was on its way downtown. He would be able to unlock it and access its call records at the PAB. He had to consider what this meant. On one hand, use of the Irvings' anniversary date tended to indicate that it had been George Irving who had set the combination on the room safe. But a wedding date could be found in court records with a computer. Once again, it was information that did not exclude either suicide or murder. He decided to move in a new direction again.
Deborah, what exactly did your husband do for a living?
She responded with a more detailed version of what Irvin Irving had already told him. George had followed in his father's footsteps, joining the LAPD at 21. But after 5 years in patrol, he left the department for law school. After earning his JD, he went to work for the city attorney's office in the contracts department. That was where he stayed until his father ran for city council and won. George quit working for the city and opened up shop as a consultant for hire, using his experience and connections to his father and others in local government and bureaucracy to give his clients access to the halls of power. George Irving had a wide range of clients, including towing firms, taxi licensees, concrete suppliers, building contractors, city office cleaners, and code enforcement litigators. He was a man who could plant the request in the right ear at the right time. If you wanted to do business with the city of Los Angeles, a man like George Irving was the one to see. He had an office in the shadow of City Hall, but the office was not where the work was done. Irving roamed the administrative wings and council offices of City Hall. That was where his work was done. The widow Irving reported that her husband's work brought them a very nice living. The house in which they sat was valued at more than $1 million, even factoring in the downturn in the economy. The work also had the propensity to bring him enemies. Unhappy clients or those competing for the same contracts as his clients. George Irving didn't operate in a world above contention.
Did he ever speak about any business or person in particular being upset with him or holding a grudge?
No one that he spoke to me about. He has an office manager, though. I guess I should say he did have an office manager. She would probably know more about this area than I would. George didn't share a lot of that with me. He didn't want me to worry about it.
What is her name?
Dana Rosen. She's been with him a long time, going back to the city attorney's office.
Have you spoken with her today?
Yes, but not since I learned.
You spoke with her before learning your husband was deceased?
Yes, when I got up, I realized he had not come home last night. He wasn't answering his cell, so at 8 o'clock I called the office and talked to Dana to see if she had seen him yet. She said no.
She said no. Bosch noted how Deborah reported what Dana Rosen had said. She didn't offer it as a true statement. He wondered if there was a problem or jealousy between the two women. Could Dana Rosen be the woman Deborah thought her husband took drives at night to meet?
But you didn't call her back after you learned of your husband's death?
No, I didn't.
Bosch wrote the name down and then closed his notebook. He thought he had plenty to start with. He hadn't covered all the details, but this was not the time for a long Q&A session. He was confident that he would be coming back to Deborah Irving. He stood up, and Chu followed suit.
I think this is enough for now, Deborah. We know it is a difficult time, and you want to be with family. Have you told your son?
No, Dad did, he called him. Chad's flying down tonight.
Where's he going to school?
USF, University of San Francisco.
Bosch nodded. He had been hearing about the school because his daughter was already thinking about the next level of education and had mentioned it as a possibility. He also remembered that it was where Bill Russell had played his college ball. Harry knew he would want to talk to the son, but didn't mention it to Deborah. There was no need to have her thinking about it.
What about friends? He asked. Was he close to anyone?
Not really. He really only had one close friend, and they hadn't seen much of each other lately.
Who was that?
His name is Bobby Mason. They knew each other since the police academy.
Is Bobby Mason still a cop?
Yes.
Why hadn't they seen each other lately?
I don't know. They just hadn't, I guess. I'm sure it was just a temporary lull in the relationship. I assume that's the way men are.
Bosch wasn't sure what her last words meant to convey about men. He didn't have anyone in his life he would consider a best friend, but he always thought he was different, that most men had male friends, even best friends. He wrote Mason's name down, then gave Deborah Irving a business card with his cell phone number on it, and invited her to call any time. He said he would be in touch as the investigation progressed. Bosch wished her good luck, and then he and Chu left. Before they reached the car, Irvin Irving came out the front door and called to them.
You were just going to leave without checking with me?
Bosch handed the keys to Chu and told him to back the car out of the driveway. He waited until he and Irving were alone before speaking.
Councilman, we need to get something straight here. I'm going to keep you informed, but I don't report to you. There's a difference. This is a police investigation, not a city hall investigation. You were a cop, but you're not anymore. You'll hear from me when I have something to report to you.
He turned and started walking toward the street.
Remember, I want an update by the end of the day, Irving called after him.
Bosch didn't respond. He kept on walking like he didn't hear. Chapter 8. Bosch told Chu to drive north toward Panorama City.
We're up here, he said. We might as well go get a look at Clayton Pell, if he's where he's supposed to be.
I thought the Irving case was the priority, Chu said.
It is.
Bosch offered no further explanation. Chu nodded, but had something else on his mind.
What about something to eat? He asked. We worked right through lunch, and I'm starving, Harry.
Bosch realized he was hungry, too. He checked his watch and saw it was almost 3.
The halfway house is way up Woodman, he said. There used to be a pretty good taco truck that parked on Woodman at Nordoff. I had a trial a few years ago at the San Fernando courthouse, and my partner and I used to hit that truck every day at lunch. It's kind of late, but if we're lucky, he'll still be there.
Chu was a partial vegetarian, but usually liked the idea of Mexican food.
Think they'll have a bean burrito on that truck?
Most likely. If not, they've got shrimp tacos. I've had them.
Sounds like a plan.
He goosed the car's accelerator. Was that Ignacio? Chu eventually asked. The partner, I mean?
Yeah, Ignacio, Bosch said.
Bosch contemplated the fate of his last partner, who was murdered in the back room of a food market 2 years earlier, while working the case that introduced Harry to Chu. The two current partners maintained silence the rest of the way. The halfway house that Clayton Pell was assigned to was in Panorama City, which was the expansive neighborhood at the geographic center of the San Fernando Valley. Spawned by post-World War II prosperity and enthusiasm, it was the first planned community of Los Angeles, replacing miles of orange groves and dairylands with the seemingly unending sprawl of inexpensive and prefabricated tract housing and low-rise apartments that soon defined the look of the valley. Anchored by the nearby industries of the General Motors plant and the Schlitz Brewery, the development represented the epoch of Los Angeles autotopia. Every man with a job and a commute, every home with a garage, every view a panorama of the surrounding mountains. Only American-born white people need apply. At least that was the way they were spinning it in 1947 when the gridwork was set and the lots went up for sale. However, over the decades since the glorious ribbon-cutting on the community of tomorrow, both GM and Schlitz pulled out, and the views of the mountains grew hazy with smog. The streets got crowded with people and traffic. The crime rate went up at a steady pace, and people started living in a lot of those garages. Iron bars went over bedroom windows, and the courtyard apartment buildings put security gates across the once wide and welcoming entrances. Graffiti marked gang turf, and finally, whereas once the name Panorama City represented a future as wide and unlimited as its 360-degree views, it was now more of a cruel irony, a place with a name that reflected very little of what was actually there. Residents in parts of the once proud suburban Nirvana routinely organized to try to break away to the adjoining neighborhoods of Mission Hills, North Hills, and even Van Nuys so as not to be associated with Panorama City. Bosch and Chu were in luck. The Tacos La Familia truck was still parked at the curb on Woodman and Nordoff. Chu found a space at the curb just two cars behind it, and they got out. The taquero was cleaning up inside and putting stuff away, but he still waited on them. There were no burritos, so Chu took shrimp tacos while Bosch went with carne asada. The man handed a squeeze bottle filled with salsa through the window. They each took a bottle of Juaritos pineapple to wash it down, and lunch for both of them was $8 total. Bosch gave the man a 10 and told him to keep the change. There were no other customers about, so Bosch took the bottle of salsa with him back to the car. He knew that when it came to truck tacos, it was all about the salsa. They ate on either side of the front hood, leaning over it so as not to drip salsa or juice on their clothes.
"Not bad, Harry," Chu said, nodding as he ate.
Bosch nodded back. His mouth was full. Finally, he swallowed and squeezed more salsa onto his second taco, and then handed the bottle across the hood to his partner. "Good salsa," he said. "You ever been to the El Matador truck in East Hollywood?"
"No, where's it at?"
"Western and Lex. This is good, but El Matador, I think, they're the best. He's only there at night, though, and everything tastes better at night anyway."
"Isn't it weird how Western Avenue is in East Hollywood?"
"I never thought about it."
"The point is, next time you're over there after work, try El Matador. Tell me what you think." Bosch realized he had not been down to the El Matador truck since his daughter had come to live with him. At the time, he didn't think eating in or on cars and getting food from trucks had been right for her. Now maybe things were different. He thought she might enjoy it, and he made a plan to take Maddie to El Matador over the weekend.
"What are we going to do with Pell?" Chu asked.
Brought back to the reality of the present, Bosch told his partner that he did not want to reveal their true interest in Clayton Pell yet. There were too many unknowns in the case. He wanted to first establish that Pell was where he was supposed to be, get a look at him, and maybe engage him in conversation, if possible, without raising the sex offender's suspicions.
"Hard to do," Chu said, his mouth full with his last bite.
"I have an idea." Bosch outlined the plan, then balled up all the foil and napkins and took it to the trash can by the back of the taco truck. He put the squeeze bottle of salsa on the window counter and waved to the taquero.
"Tacos grandes!"
"Gracias."
Chu was behind the wheel when he got back to the car. They made a U-turn and started down Woodman. Bosch's phone buzzed, and he checked the screen. It was a number out of the PAB, but he didn't recognize it. He took the call. It was Marshall Collins, the commander of the Media Relations Unit.
"Detective Bosch, I'm holding them at bay, but we're going to need to put something out on Irving today."
"There's nothing yet to put out."
"Can you give me anything?
I've gotten 26 calls here. What can I tell them?"
Bosch thought for a moment, wondering if there was a way to use the media to help the investigation.
"Tell them that cause of death is under investigation.
Mr. Irving dropped from the 7th-floor balcony of his room at the Chateau Marmont. It is unknown at this time whether it was accident, suicide, or homicide. Anyone with information about Mr. Irving's last hours at the hotel or before should contact the Robbery Homicide Division, etc., etc. You know how to put it. So, no suspect at this time. Don't put that out. That implies I am looking for suspects. We aren't even to that point yet. We don't know what happened, and we're going to have to wait on autopsy results as well as the ongoing gathering of information."
"Okay, got it. We'll get it out there."
Bosch closed the phone and relayed details of the conversation to Chu. In 5 minutes, they came to the Buena Vista Apartments. It was a two-story courtyard complex with Major League Security gating and signage warning those without business to stay away. Not only were solicitors not welcome, but children were on the no-go list as well. There was a public notice locked in a case mounted on the gate that gave warning that the facility was used to house sexual offenders on probation and parole and undergoing continuing treatment. The case's thick plastic window was scratched and marred from many efforts to shatter it and paint it with graffiti. To push the door buzzer, Bosch had to reach his arm up to the elbow through a small opening in the gate. He then waited, and a female voice eventually responded,
"What is it?"
"LAPD. We need to speak to whoever's in charge."
"She's not here."
"Then I guess we need to speak to you. Open up." There was a camera on the other side of the gate, located far enough back to make it difficult to be vandalized. Bosch reached his hand through the opening again with his badge and held it up. A few more moments went by, and the door lock buzzed. He and Chu pushed through. The gate led to a tunnel-like entrance, which took them to the center courtyard. As Bosch reached daylight again, he saw several men sitting on chairs in a circle, a counseling and rehab session. He had never put much stock in the idea of rehabilitating sexual predators. He didn't think there was a cure beyond castration, surgical preferred over chemical. But he was smart enough to keep such thoughts to himself, depending on the company he was with. Bosch scanned the men in the circle, hoping to recognize Clayton Pell, but to no avail. Several men had their backs to the entrance, and others were hunched over and hiding their faces below baseball hats or with hands over their mouths in poses of deep thought. Many of them were checking out Bosch and Chu. They would be easily made as cops by the men in the circle. A few seconds later, they were approached by a woman with a name tag on the breast of her hospital scrubs. It said Dr. Hannah Stone. She was attractive, with reddish-blonde hair, tied back in a no-nonsense manner. She was mid-40s, and Bosch noticed that her watch was on her right wrist, and it partially covered a tattoo.
"I'm Dr. Stone. Can I see your identification, gentlemen?"
Bosch and Chu opened their wallets. Their police IDs were checked and then quickly handed back to them.
"Come with me, please. It will be better if the men didn't see you out here."
"Might be too late for that," Bosch said. She didn't answer. They were led into an apartment on the front of the building that had been converted into offices and private therapy rooms. Dr. Stone told them that she was the rehabilitation program director. Her boss, the facility manager and director, was downtown at a budget meeting all day. She was very curt and to the point.
"What can I do for you, detectives?"
There was a defensive tone in every word she had spoken so far, even the words about the budget meeting. She knew that cops didn't appreciate what was done here, and she was ready to defend it. She didn't appear to be a woman who would back down on anything.
"We're investigating a crime," Bosch said. "A rape and murder. We have a description of a suspect we think might be in here. White male, 28 to 32 years old. He's got dark hair, and his first or last name might begin with the letter C. That letter was tattooed on the suspect's neck." So far, Bosch had not told a lie. The rape and murder actually happened. He just left out the part about its being 22 years ago. His description matched Clayton Pell to a T, because Bosch had gotten the ex-convict's descriptors off the state parole board's computer records. And the DNA hit made Pell a suspect, no matter how unlikely it was that he was involved in the Venice Beach slang.
"So, anybody here that meets that description?" he asked. Stone hesitated before speaking. Bosch was hoping she wasn't going to come to the defense of the men in her program. It didn't matter how successful programs claimed to be. Any recidivism among sexual offenders was too high.
"There is someone here," she finally said. "But he's made tremendous progress in the last 5 months. I find it hard to..."
"What's his name?" Bosch asked, cutting her off.
"Clayton Pell. He's out there in the circle right now."
"How often is he allowed to leave this facility?"
4 hours a day. He has a job."
"A job?" Chu asked. "You just let these people loose?"
"Detective, this is not a lockdown facility. Every man here is here voluntarily. They are paroled from prison and have to register with the county and then find a place to live where they are not in violation of rules for sex offenders. We contract with the county to run a living facility that fits within those requirements. But no one has to live here. They do so because they want to assimilate back into society. They want to be productive. They don't want to hurt anyone. If they come here, we provide counseling and job placement. We feed them and give them a bed. But the only way they can stay is if they follow our rules. We work closely with the Department of Probation and Parole, and our recidivism rate is better than the national average."
"But it's not perfect," Bosch said. "For many of them, once a predator, always a predator."
"For some, that is true. But what choice do we have but to try? When people have completed their sentences, they must be released into society. This program may be one of the best last chances of preventing future crimes."
Bosch realized that Stone was insulted by their questions. They had made their first false move. He didn't want this woman working against them. He wanted her cooperation.
"Sorry," he said. "I'm sure the program is worthwhile. I was just thinking about the details of the crime we're investigating."
Bosch stepped over to the front window and looked out into the courtyard.
"Which one is Clayton Pell?"
Stone came up next to him and pointed.
"The man with the shaved head on the right. That's him."
"When did he shave his head?"
"A few weeks ago."
"When was the attack you're investigating?"
Bosch turned and looked at her. Before that. She looked at him and nodded. She got the message. He was here to ask questions, not be asked.
You said he has a job.
Doing what?
He works for the Grande Mercado up near Roscoe. He works in the parking lot, collecting the shopping carts and emptying trash cans, that sort of thing. They pay him $25 a day. It keeps him in cigarettes and potato chips. He's addicted to both.
What are the hours he works?
They vary by the day. His schedule is posted at the market. Today he went to work early and just got back.
It was good to know about the schedule being available at the market. It would help if they later wanted to pick up Pell away from the Buena Vista facility.
Dr. Stone, is Pell one of your patients?
She nodded.
I have sessions with him 4 times a week. He works with other therapists here, too.
What can you tell me about him?
I can't tell you anything about our sessions. The doctor-patient confidentiality bond exists, even in this sort of situation.
Yeah, I get that, but the evidence in our case indicates he abducted, raped, and then strangled a 19-year-old girl. I need to know what makes the man sitting out there in that circle tick.
Wait a minute. Just wait.
She put up her hand in a stop gesture.
You said a 19-year-old girl?
That's right, and his DNA was found on her. Again, not a lie, but not the whole truth.
That's impossible.
Don't tell me it's impossible. The science isn't wrong.
Well, it is this time. Clayton Pell didn't rape a 19-year-old girl. First of all, he is a homosexual, and he's a pedophile. Almost all of the men here are. They are predators convicted of crimes against children. Second, 2 years ago, he was assaulted in prison by a group of men, and he was castrated. So there is no way that Clayton Pell is your suspect.
Bosch heard a sharp intake of breath from his partner. He, too, was shocked by the doctor's revelation, as well as how it echoed the thoughts he had had as he entered the facility.
Clayton's sickness is that he is obsessed with prepubescent boys, Stone continued. I would have thought you'd do a little homework before you came here.
Bosch stared at her for a long moment as the burn of embarrassment colored his face. Not only had the ruse he had planned been disastrously wrong, but there was now even further evidence that something was seriously amiss in the Lily Price case. Struggling to move away from his gaffe, he blurted out a question. Prepubescent. You're talking about 8-year-olds? 10-year-olds? Why that age?
I can't go into it, Stone said. You're crossing into confidential territory.
Bosch walked back to the window and looked out at Clayton Pell in the circle session. He was sitting up straight in his chair and looked to be closely following the conversation. He wasn't one of those who hid his face, and there was no outward show of the trauma he had suffered.
Does everybody in the circle know? Only I know, and I made a serious breach having just told you. The group sessions are of great therapeutic value to most of our residents. That's why they come here. That's why they stay.
Bosch could have argued that they stayed because of the shelter and food, but he raised his hands in surrender and apology.
Doctor, do us a favor, he said. Don't tell Pell that we were here asking about him.
I wouldn't. It would only upset him. If I'm asked, I will simply say you two were here to investigate the latest vandalism.
Sounds good. What was the latest vandalism?
My car. Someone spray-painted, "I love baby rapers," on the side. They'd like to